time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 21st of January 2012. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oneroa. On Saturday the 21st of January, Sharon Brown talked to Dawn Jeffries about the Waiheke Plum Drive, Bernie Rhodes about the Waiheke Sail Project, Rian Atterberg about the upcoming food bill, and Huhana Davis from Piritahi Marae.
Okay, lovely. Hi Dawn, how's it going?
Good morning, Sharon.
So, tell us, so the Plum Drive, so last year, was that Maureen who was doing that?
Well, it was actually 2 years ago, it was January 2010, and Maureen was definitely involved, and I believe it was initiated with James Samuel and Pete Russell, who founded Ubi. And it was about waste not, want not. And we have a lot of fruit trees on the island, and some of these plums just fall on the ground and don't get used. So it was about using those plums and just getting people together for a fun event.
Lovely. Yeah. And you've been making jam for a while, haven't you?
Have
you
started selling your stuff? Well, I make some at home, and I've done a bit of trading and selling. I kind of grew up around preserves. My family had a big garden and lots of fruit trees, and so it was always happening in the kitchen at home. And since becoming a mother myself, I've been drawn to it. And since I've been involved with the kindy, Fossil Bay Kindergarten, I've been making lots of preserves for the harvest fair, stall. So
it's really interesting, isn't it? Because I'd never made preserves, but I found that when I was a mother, I don't know if it's that thing of you've got some sort of product at the end of it as opposed to, housework.
It's quite satisfying. It's kind of, you spend a lot of time at home when you're a mother, and it's part of that nesting, nurturing, wholesome environment that I think most mothers want to embrace. Mm.
So what kinds of things have you made?
Preserves.
What are your favourite things?
Lots of different ones. I mean, plum jam is really one of my favourites, and it's generally the first preserves that I do for the season. But one of my favourites was what I made last year for the fair, and that was a something you probably like. It was a eggplant, mm-hmm. like a spicy eggplant chutney. And, yeah, that's my all-time favourite.
So oh, really? Yeah. Oh, interesting, because I know Maureen makes an eggplant chutney that I... it's a Burmese one, but my ex-partner, who was from Israel, he used to love it, and it had a really sort of Moroccan flavour to it, but it was just
I'll have to
beautiful.
Talk to Maureen about that next
yeah.
weekend.
Well, because eggplants were so expensive, she decided she was going to grow her own this year. And, of course, eggplants have come down in price now.
And that's it. It's all about what's seasonal and what you can source without buying it at top dollar. So it's about using seasonal products, which is great. Mm.
Yeah. And where do you find your recipes? Do you make them up, or do you adapt them from recipes?
I adapt a lot of recipes, but generally I start with a recipe and I'll use that one as it is, and then once I've got confident with it, then I might adapt it. Yeah.
Lovely. Okay, so tell us about the Plum Drive. Yeah. People want to be involved. How does that work?
Yeah, so the Plum Drive is next Saturday. It's at the Palm Beach Hall, and we'll be there from 9 o'clock. And so just come on down, bring your plums, bring your clean jars with lids, bring your apron, and just get involved. There'll be lots of different things to do, from cutting the plums, cleaning the jars, stirring the pots, pouring the plums into the jars. There's a wonderful young artist on the island, Helen Burt, and she's designed a label for us. So putting labels on the jars. And we might have some live music. If any local musicians would like to come down, we'd love to hear from you. And John from your station here, he'll be coming down and doing a few live interviews and creating a little story of the day, which will be wonderful.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah good. And how does it work? You bring a couple of jars down, and then you take a couple of jars of jam away?
They did last time was for say a dozen jars, we'd record all these details of who's bringing what, and then you'd be given a a jar of jam, or for a supermarket bag of plums, again, and also for people that are involved on the day giving their time. We've been really fortunate this year to have some great sponsors to cover our costs. Ubi's covered the cost of the hall for us.
Oh,
thank you,
that's
Ubi.
Really nice.
And Countdown has covered the sugar. We needed 50 kgs of sugar.
Wow.
That's quite
that's
a bit.
That's good.
Yeah. At the end of the day, we should have still jars of jam left, and we will sell those in various ways, possibly a stall at the Ostend Market. And then, so the money that we make, we are going to donate to a community group. We haven't decided which group yet. We thought on the day we'll talk to those involved and have a bit of a consensus about which group people feel is most needy at the time. Yeah.
Lovely. Oh, well, that sounds like a great initiative. Good luck with that.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay, so the Great Plum Drive next Saturday, 9 o'clock, Palm Beach Hall.
Yes.
And what time would people expect to finish?
Well, we've booked the hall till 2.
Okay.
I think, yeah, it's hard to know how many plums will come. And one last thing, if people have plums or jars in the meantime, perhaps can't come on the day, they could give me a call on 9022 and I'll arrange for somebody to pick them up.
Okay, lovely. And tomorrow there's a big event at the radio, which is a big radio CD record sale. So if people had jars, presumably they could just drop them off here at the same time.
Fantastic
and then you could
idea.
Just stop in and I'm sure we could make a little corner.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Sharon.
And then you could just pick everything up from here.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Now, I did have one last question, which is about the plums. Is it a bad year? Not a bad year, but it seems like a slow year for plums.
Yeah.
I didn't have very many on the tree.
There are some trees that have no fruit on this year, and that's just nature. And some aren't ripe yet, and some were ripe weeks ago and are in people's freezers waiting. So we'll just roll with the plums on the day.
Okay, great. So if you want to roll with the plums, come along next Saturday. Great. Okay. Thanks a lot, Dawn.
Thank you.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
Hi, well, here we are with the with Bernard Rhodes and the Waiheke Sale Project. That was Kula Shaker. And so Bernard, you've just come from the Wharf to Wharf run. So what have you been doing for that?
Oh, this is the Waiheke Boating Club runs a water stop every year for the Wharf to Wharf run. So down on the causeway, handing out cups of water to all the competitors as they go rushing past or strolling past or gasping past, whatever, and picking up the mess again afterwards, yeah.
Lovely. So were there a lot of people running through?
Yes, we're coming through thick and fast 20 minutes ago when I left there, yes.
Great. And when are the contestants going to be arriving at the finish line?
I'm not sure. I guess, was it Mark Bright was right in the lead, I think, by a long way. And, he might have finished already. I don't know.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Lovely. Good. And is Scott Winton doing it this year?
Yeah. I saw him go past. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It might be him that's winning. I'm afraid I don't keep up much with that. Yes.
Okay, well, it'll be interesting to see. Mm. Lovely. So you've been involved in the Waiheke Sale Project.
Hmm.
What's it actually called?
Waiheke Working Sale is the name we've given to our group, yes, that's organising it.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And so what is it exactly?
Well, it started at a meeting of friends looking at a green movie. A friend, Marta Fish, said... Look, we order our organic food twice a year in bulk. Would it be possible to bring it across by sailing boat? I said, yes, but not economically. Obviously, the mass production system we have now is very economical in terms of getting food, goods to the island. But we'll have a look at it some further. And this coincided with a desire of mine to get more sail training going for young people of New Zealand. I have in the past volunteered on Spirit of New Zealand and found it immensely satisfying seeing the young people come aboard wondering what on earth they've let themselves in for and looking at the rigging with trepidation and then going away at the end of 9 days just going, yay, I can do it, and having really grown in themselves. It's not so much just learning to sail, although that's part of it. It's they call it youth development. It's young people finding themselves. And the other partner, Millie Watkins and Andrew, are interested in the educational side of things. They're concerned that young people looking towards a very uncertain future, young people need to learn skills that are going to be useful to them for the future. Boat building skills, sailing skills, navigation, that kind of thing. So this all sort of came together in a group, and the upshot was that I drew up concept drawings for a 60-foot long topsail schooner, which could be built in wood on the island, using wood that's grown on the island. This is thanks, there is also modern technology involved, the epoxy resin systems that we use for boat building these days. They allow non-durable timbers such as Pinus radiata that's growing everywhere, the pines you see everywhere, and even balsa wood, to be used for boat building by sealing it in epoxy resin. It stops the wood from getting wet, and so it becomes quite durable. And my own boat, Flying Carpet, is built that way. She's lasted 22 years and still good. And another boat I know I've built that way is still good. So the system is proven, and we've got this tremendous resource on the island of pine trees growing all over the place. Many of them too knotty, really, for boat building, but quite a lot of them have straight parts in them and could potentially be a valuable resource.
Wow. So was that difficult to design a boat, a 60-foot boat? That sounds like quite a well, is that a different league to what you've been building so far?
That's my passion. I've been involved in boat design pretty well all my life. I designed and built my first canoe when I was 13, and by 15 I had a racing sailing canoe that could beat everything inside if you could keep it upright. And I designed and built my own little boat in England, which I sailed out to New Zealand 1966 through to 69. Never made a living at yacht design. It's very difficult to do that, really, but I've always liked to experiment, so I've designed and built my own boats over the years, and still sailing boats that I've designed and built in Ostend here, yes.
Mm. So what are the requirements for that kind of boat? So you're talking about a cargo boat, or you're talking about... I'm not...
Yes, this is a new departure in that it should be dual purpose. It can carry cargo, and it's a training ship as well. Basically, the big central space called the hold, it has canvas bunks all around the sides of it for the trainees, to just basic canvas with a thin mattress on them. And the central area normally would have tables and chairs and be a lecture room and dining area. These can be cleared away, and pallets of cargo can be dropped in through the hatch, either using the ship's own gear and pulley hauling methods, or by a hayab on the wharf, sort of thing. Yeah.
Mm, okay. And so, are you looking at how much would this cost to do? Are there any ideas?
Well, this is very much a rough guess at present. I'm using a number of $750,000 because that's what it cost to rebuild the old scow Jane Gifford up at Warkworth there. I think it would be easier to build a new boat than what they did, basically encasing what was left of the old boat in timber inside and out, and a really major reconstruction job. But what I'm finding is there's tremendous goodwill for this project on the island, and we've already been given some trees still standing. I have to go and have a look if they're suitable. And several people, friends of mine, have said, oh, I'd love to work on this project. This may be voluntary labour or semi-voluntary for a subsistence wage. I'm prepared to put in my professional expertise into the early design stage if we can also get sponsors to put in some money to make it happen. Mm. So it's a matter of just getting it off the ground now, looking around, seeing who's interested.
So how many trees would you need for something like this? Can you gauge that? Or, I mean...
Very hard to say, because a lot of the trees, as I say, are partly too knotty for boat building work. They're really, on the island, they're rubbish. They're good for pulping for paper, but it's not economic to transport them. And it depends how big the trees are. When I built Flying Carpet, my catamaran here, I started by buying a chainsaw with a milling attachment, and we cut down a big macrocarpa tree that was on our border with a Maori ceremony to ask Tane's permission to put it in the service of Tangaroa. And we seasoned the timber for 2 years, and the best of it went into the boat, and the rest went to building the workshop, and we had some very nice... tabletops and sink bench tops out of it as well. And I was given trees that were already felled on the island, so at that stage I was on the dole, thanks to Muldoon and his boat tax. So we worked really hard going around milling trees and hauling the slabs back home and filleting and stacking and seasoning them. Got our timber, you could say, for the price of a bit of petrol and a lot of sweat and hard labour.
A lot of sweat sounds bad.
But these are skills that are really quite valuable to learn for young people. And if we can get, you know, kids on work experience or one or two apprentices coming along, helping out, some volunteer labour. Already I have a couple of more very nice macro carpet trees belonging to a friend of mine who says, well, if somebody can come and mill them, they can have half of it, you know. And they're really nice, clean, straight trees with beautiful timber in them. So
and do they they also have this issue that you need to epoxy them to make them?
Macrocarpa is naturally durable and it's not so critical to epoxy at all, but I would do that nevertheless. It maintains the strength of the timber, and if we can get macrocarpa, it would be good for exposed parts like railings and so on that get knocked around a lot. I've found.
So if one were to cargo things from Auckland, how long would it take?
Well, it would depend on the wind and the tides. Roughly speaking, you could do a return trip to Panmure Wharf, say, in about 6 hours, including loading at the wharf. It'd take an hour or two to load, 2 or 3 hours to go up there. Ideally, you would sail in on a flood tide, so it helps you up the river, and come back on the ebb tide, and then run on the beach somewhere in Waiheke to unload at low tide. So you get one trip, round trip in a day comfortably, and when the tides are early morning and late evening, you might even do two in a day. We're also looking at, is anybody growing organic food down at Thames and Coromandel and would have substantial quantities to ship over here? Well into the future, with the price of diesel likely to go up through the roof, is it best to go into Auckland City to look for our food? Do we go up to Riverhead and tack on to Dargaville where they grow the kumara? That sort of a thing. So
how long would it take you up to Dargaville?
To Riverhead's quite a long way. Again, you'd want to work the tides. You would do an all-day trip with the tide serving right. Leave early morning, you'd be back late evening, I'd say.
And how many crew would you need to do that?
The ship could be operated with two crew, a skipper and a mate, and I envisaged they would be full-time professionals. They'd be paid to be on the ship and look after the ship. And then it can take up to 10 trainees on a regular basis, 12 maximum, and two volunteer crew who would look after trainees, and they'd be sort of watch leaders. Yeah.
So how many days a week does one anticipate this would be sailing?
Well,
ideally you'd be doing 3 or 4 days a week or something.
Yes, it would. If you're running trainee voyages, either 5 day or 10 day voyages, possibly. The 5 days, I think, is a minimum to really get to know the ship. And they're finding on Spirit of New Zealand that the school curriculum is getting tighter and less time is available. And so they're doing some 5 day voyages as well as their 10 day youth development voyages.
It'd be amazing for the schools, wouldn't it?
Well, yes. I really feel every kid in New Zealand deserves a chance at this, you know. And the Spirit is the only big ship doing it. There's another one in the Bay of Islands doing a very similar thing, the R. Tucker Thompson. She's carrying passengers in the summer and I believe doing some sail training in the winter. I want to go and research that, see what they're up to.
Well, it sounds tremendous. So is this all just pie in the sky, or is there what stage are we in this process? You've designed, you've suggested a design for a boat.
Yes, I have this. It's just a very fundamental concept drawing which shows that 60 feet long on deck, 18 metres, is big enough to do what I envisaged, the 10 trainees and maybe 15, 20 tonnes of cargo. We gave a presentation last Monday as part of the Sustainability Festival here. We had 30 people turned up and a lot of enthusiasm and so on. And we need to really put it out some more, talk to other groups on the island, possibly Rotary and other similar groups, and just put it out there and see what response we get. If and as and when we get sufficient response, then the first early stages can go ahead, milling timber and getting the design, take it to a naval architect who's fully computerized and get plans drawn up properly. At that point, you can get a much better estimate of the cost. You can get quantities of materials and so on.
Mm. Yeah. And is there a risk when you build a boat that it actually won't float? Or is that why you have the naval architect? Or
well,
I just imagine something
yes,
that hasn't been done before.
My boats have all floated. yeah, one or two of them have been lighter than... Well, one in particular was lighter than I guesstimated, but I was being squeezed on the price of my fees, my services there was really rock bottom. with modern computers, all the calculations that were so tedious to do by hand are done at the press of a button now, and you can be quite accurate, really, in estimating the weight of the boat and the way it's going to float and how much ballast you're going to need and the stability of the boat. Again, stability calculations are they're required now for safe ship management and for a license for passenger carrying and training ships. Very rigorous safety regulations. All these will be complied with. We anticipate making the ship fully compliant. Yeah.
Sounds like an amazing project.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm excited by it. I think it could be a really worthwhile thing to do. And the idea is, my initial drawings, it would be a tall ship, a topsail schooner. It's got square rig on the foremast. And this is two reasons. One is there's nothing like square rig for sail training. You have to go aloft to furl the sails properly, and as you get the trainees doing this with their safety harnesses on, it's really a challenge for them. And being aloft when the ship's sailing is something I just love to do myself. You're up there, you can look down on the ship plying along below you and look way out to the horizon, and it's a kind of a godlike feeling up there. And just
God,
an experience
just
not to be missed.
I think what's also nice about it is it's got a feeling around it of people who are older, who've worked a lot in boats, working together with kids who are, you know, gaining experiences. So it's a nice way of different age groups contributing to something that can be done together.
Yeah, well, this is largely, but particularly Millie Watkins, our other partner, is interested in this, and that these skills are passed on to younger people. And I found it a great pleasure to be teaching young people to sail, and as long as they're interested and not totally diverted on their iPods or whatever it is they have these days.
Mm.
Yeah,
I was quite interested in Samoa. There were a few outrigger canoes. A lot of things have been lost in the tsunami, the big boats, but there are still a few outrigger canoes around. But they were saying that there are very, very few people who actually know anything about making those canoes now. So they're really sturdy, and they've been around for years and years and years. But it's very hard to find people who can actually build them.
Yes, I've observed this sailing around the Pacific. It only takes one generation for all these old skills to be lost. Yes. And even 1968, I sailed into the Tuamotu Islands, the island where the Contika raft was wrecked, and there were only one or two of the old people still remembered how to sail. The rest of it's motorboats, motorboats. And as we went sailing on my little boat in the lagoon, the old people were sort of showing the young people, this is how wind pushes boats along, and a generation now has lost it. Some has revived, with the festival, the racing of outrigger canoes and festivals, and these Waka Ama clubs that have come out all over the Pacific, a really terrific, great sport. But the actual building them from dugouts, of course, was very labour intensive. But the Maori people here, of course, Heck Busby in particular, has revived that, and it's now a source of great pride, to the Maori people.
And to make outriggers boats from scratch.
Hollow it out of a kauri log. He uses a chainsaw now and power tools, of course, and who wouldn't? The way the logs have to be carefully dried so they don't split, and the way you lay the log down so its strongest part is in the keel, and he's picked up a huge amount of the remnants of the ancient knowledge, and figured stuff out for himself as well.
Oh, lovely. So he's made a few of these, or at least one.
The Maori people have.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Particularly okay. Heck Busby up north.
Okay.
Yes.
Terrific. Right. Well, thanks very much. Good luck with that project. And yeah. How can people get involved, or what's the next stage or the outcome of that meeting?
Yes. We're going to put up the contents of that presentation on our website. That's you got www, don't you, always? And then Waiheke Working Sales. So that's www.onewaiheke.com.
Okay, yeah. Right. But I'm sure if you just do a search for Waiheke Working Sale, there's not going to be too many of them.
I guess it'll come up, yes. Andrew Watkins is our computer guru, and
yes.
He's set up this website. And this very weekend he's intending to put up the contents of the presentation on it, the slides and what we were saying and putting out about it, yes.
Great. Okay, well, thank you very much. Good luck with that.
Oh, you're welcome.
So you've been listening to Bernard Rhodes talking about the Waiheke Working Sale project, and there'll be some information and a website. Is the website up yet, or it's...
The website is up. The information is being added this weekend, yes. And you can log on and so on. Yeah, that's coming.
Find out what's going on and perhaps get involved. Okay, well, we've got Rien Achtenberg coming in now to talk about the food bill. He's a small grower and jam maker. Hi, Rien, how are you doing?
Hi, Sharon. Good, good. Yep.
Yeah, good.
Yep.
So you make jam and
jams
sell it
and
at
chutneys
the market?
And olives and stuff, yeah.
Lovely. So there's a new food bill that's being considered.
Yeah,
and it's actually been around for a year, but no one's really done too much about it. But now people seem to be galvanized into action. Is it all smoke and mirrors, or is there something to be concerned about in this food bill?
I think there is very much to be concerned about. Well, it seemed to be that the good side is that they're talking about taking the things about seeds out of there, but it's one step into the great, what I can see is the great conspiracy to take over the whole food market by companies like Monsanto. That has been happening overseas in Canada, India, Mexico, and a lot of places, and they're pushing very hard to squeeze out anybody with heritage seeds or small gardeners, and to monopolize the whole seed and for, in that respect, the grower's market. And it becomes the industrial grower market, preferably all with their seeds, which are a lot of them, and they're pushing, you know, that's their expertise. GMO, genetically modified organisms.
How is that expressed in the bill? Do you know? Are you familiar with the actual bill?
I'm not 100% familiar with the bill, but I've been following it a little bit, what's been going on overseas. Like, I have been overseas recently for about 6-7 months in Europe and doing Greenpeace-y stuff. So, and there is a bit of a thing happening with Monsanto, that they're trying to take that over, and there's a lot of concern and even protests and occupations going on at Monsanto's offices in Canada and in India, and because the small farmers or organic farmers, even industrial organic farmers as such, are being made impossible to use non-GE seeds, or they have GE seeds used in the neighborhood, so pollination screws up their pollination and stuff like that.
Yeah, I noticed they took someone to court, didn't they, in the States, because they'd actually experienced drift from GE seeds onto their non-GE ground, but Monsanto took them to court on the grounds that they'd somehow been ripping them off in their use of seeds or something. It's
yeah.
Peculiar.
And because this food bill is tied in basically with the World Trade Organization and the Free Trade Pacts we have or are about to sign up to, it means everything is going to be more globalized. So, and the US is pushing that in particularly. Well, the U.S. government, the lobbyists for Monsanto and the U.S. government are very, very close. Like, just very recently, a few days ago, came out again the thing that four or five U.S. senators in Hawaii, Hawaiian senators, have been bribed so to push the food bill through in Hawaii. So, slowly but surely, they're taking over, and it's a slow creeping process. We are tied into that, with the U.S. putting pressure on governments who they have trade agreements with to allow those sort of companies to market and sell their stuff in places like New Zealand. So that's been happening in India. Now in India, it's a very good example, they have farmers not only committing suicide because they don't have heritage seeds anymore and they have to buy every year new seed. And the seed is not really suitable for local conditions, so they got crop failures besides as well. You know, therefore not being able to feed their kids and having to rely on imported seed, which, yeah, basically not suitable for growing conditions. So people getting in destitute straits. The heritage seeds, their original seeds, rice varieties and whatever, are not available anymore. Having seeds
so
important.
I'm quite interested because this is the scary part of
this food bill, that slowly but surely, with a food bill like this, companies can start pushing GE and will have to allow it, otherwise trade sanctions will be applied to us.
And you think that's a threat within this food bill? Because I haven't necessarily noticed that, but then I haven't read the bill, and I thought they were taking that out.
Of course, they're not going to say that in the bill. And they may take some things out, like the seed thing, which is a good thing, I applaud that. You know, if that's going to happen, that would be good. But it's still a slow creep, and it's a beginning of a slippery slope we're on. And I think the New Zealand government should really take note what's happening overseas with the food bills in Canada, India, Mexico, or
the United States and the U.S.
In particular.
I think for me, it's interesting that you mentioned the seeds, because when I look at it, for me, it's around the cost of organic food going up and keeping it marginalized. So normally you have a supply and demand model, and what I think people are asking for around the world is, if we could afford it, we would buy organic food, or food that we could guarantee as being GMO free. And so now, especially as supermarket food is climbing, the cost of organics it's not exactly dropping, but you can buy organic food like I do. I buy my organic food, or I grow it, but I buy it at pretty much the same price as I would pay in the supermarket. And that refers to bread, beans, whatever. And so what's happening is that they're stopping this, or they're making the compliance costs for the small growers and the independent growers so high that they're keeping the cost of that incredibly high, rather than changing the way they operate to allow more people to eat organic food and the food that they genuinely want to eat. So for me, that's more of a threat under the food bill.
That is a big threat under the food bill. Like, we had a few years ago the big fight, you know, with people on the market stalls here, from when Auckland City wanted to introduce, you know, health regulations and tighten things up, and everybody had to do health and safety courses, and wear condoms over their bodies so they wouldn't contaminate the food or whatever, you know. And we had to. We were supposed to pay $75 for this and $100 for that. Okay, we fought that, and we got Waiheke got exempt.
Oh, interesting.
So, exempt to the extent, you know, the costs were put down for us to $25 a year, compared by Auckland City, people had to pay hundreds of dollars to have a market stall. So we were still being okay for the last few years.
And are you happy
with this food bill? Auckland City will slowly increase that price to bring us on level with the rest of the city, because we're part of the city, and bring us in line with government regulations. So it's a slow creep, you know, every time a little bit, maybe two steps forward, and then they may take a step backwards, but then they later on, a year later, they take another two steps. So it's this.
Are you happy with the current food handling laws? I mean, in the way they affect you? Because from what I can gather, in terms of the food that we buy from the market, I've never been sick from anything I've bought at the market. It all seems, yeah. I mean, it is grown in people's kitchens that
it's
are
It's a bit of regulation,
compliant.
Over-regulation in a way, and because maybe somebody got sick at one stage, at some stage in Dunedin or Bluff, you know, so it had tightened up. So, yes, in a way I can say I'm happy with it because it's still fairly easy, but I still have to pay a license fee. While before, I never had complaints about people getting sick of my produce, or if something wasn't too good, people come back and talk to you about it. Like, you get squeezed out of the market. If your product is not good, people are not going to come back and buy it. So,
I think the other issue,
again, it's a... You know, why do I need that piece of paper to prove that I can make a jam? I know I can make a jam. I'm a qualified chef. I know I can make jams. And nobody ever got poisoned with my stuff. And if I do, I lose my little market share, you know, my 1 or 2 days that I have a little stall outside.
I think
Oh, you lost the thread.
Okay.
Sharon lost the plot.
I lost the plot. No.
Yeah. She saw a really nice young man walking by.
That's right.
Yeah.
The other thought that that occurred to me was the thing that the poisoning that occurs through food tends to be things like salmonella from chicken, or it's things to do with the poultry and dairy industry, and it happens perhaps at
the cancer rates going up, and the bees are dying. Like, it's all.
And then the other thing is that there's nothing in this bill that talks about the health hazards of GMO produce, and there's nothing that talks about, say, food labelling or things that people genuinely are concerned about. I want to know whether my food has GMO ingredients in it, and I want to know that if I'm buying some pork, that when it says product of New Zealand and other countries, that the actual pork is a product of New Zealand, not that the actual, you know, big pork thing that I'm buying is the product of the other country and the salt is the product of New Zealand. So it's not really addressing the concerns that people have, and then it seems to be cracking down on the smaller growers and producers and marginalizing them.
Yeah, that's the contradiction. Like, in a way, we're saying, okay, we don't want over-regulation. On the other hand, we want to give people also the option of to choose wisely, properly, and have the information available. So that may need some regulation with regard to what's on a packet of pork, for that matter, or tofu or whatever. And that's not really available, and that's a big battle happening everywhere. And the food industry, the industrial large-scale corporate food industry, doesn't really want that, because that add cost, and that cost will come back to the customer again, us, the taxpayer. Besides, they don't really want to be questioned. They just want to make profit, like they're owned by shareholders. They have to make a profit. So the less troublesome we are, the better. Keep people stupid. Like, that's what this government's all about. You know, John Key, lovely guy, so we vote for him. But it keeps everybody stupid and not thinking about what the real issues are. You know, it's like, okay, we are here on the island, quite conscious and aware and pretty green and all that stuff. But how many people are in the country who are aware about this food bill stuff, who will go a bit more in-depth? And even I am a greenie, supposed to be. I'm not even having read the whole bloody thing, you know. Well, I maybe should have, but okay, I've got a life as well outside.
Yes, no, exactly. Who's got the time?
So, but I came back from Europe, and that's the first thing I saw somewhere on New Zealand website, this food bill thing. So I fired straight up. I was like, oh no, you know, like, this
and
is
we're
stuff
constantly.
I read overseas.
I mean, I remember we were under attack from G trials in the South Island, done by Ag Research, and every couple of years there's something to do with G and labelling and food and whatever. So it keeps coming up. So
It's a big now, push from the big companies, from the big corporates like the Monsanto.
Wakey Radio. And now I've got Fire Huhana and Matua Eugene, who've come in to talk about the hui next week as a welcome for Denise Roche, who's the new Green Auckland MP, and the food bill Hui that's been roped in as part of that. Good morning.
Good morning.
Kia
ora. Kia ora.
And good. So tell us what's happening next Saturday then.
Kia ora whai, kia ora koutou, Waiheke Island. Yes, we have a hui on our marae, and that's to endorse our firefighter Denise in her representation of us as our Greens representative for these next 3 years, and optimistically continuing. So, nō mai hurumai, koutou katoa, all welcome. Come to Piritahi Marae, Blackpool, next Saturday the 28th at 11 a.m. This will include a discussion, open forum on sharing full information on this food bill. So particularly important for us from a marae, from our Tūranga Waewae perspective, and just to share some of those thoughts that this is a threat to our fundamental principles of life. It is undermining our self-determination, as we term tina rangatiratanga. We oppose any move which affects the self-sustaining rights of our Indigenous communities to produce, share, trade food and seed. We heard the kōrero, the discussions about the effects that this is about, actually World Trade Organization agreements, multinational food corporations, which will use genetically engineered seeds and are using aggressive lobbying tactics to undermine our GE-free food systems. So the main thing is that this bill will apply to any individual's business which sells, supply food in exchange for payment, including food that is bartered, donated or given simply as a trade principle. From a kaupapa Māori perspective, it's about our DNA genes. This is our whakapapa. We talk, we believe in Rangi Nui and Papa Tuanuku, Sky Father, Mother Earth, and all that comes from that. We are but an extension of our environment. This is our whanaungatanga, our family connectedness. So all things connect from us through our spirituality, through our gods, and this is about Māori, our connected life force, our living connected life force. So recognising that these are dynamic balances in today's world, that of matter and being, that of spiritual and physical. And these are integral parts of our future sustainability. These are our grandchildren, as a family, as a mother, as a teacher, food teacher of Waiheke High School, as a mother of 9, grandparents of over 20 and great-grandparents. We, as an immediate family, and certainly my tāne Eugene, for many years that has been in our mara gardens, taught by our tupuna, growing kai that has strong spiritual relevance, not here and not just for here and now, but for the future. Strong spiritual relevance that goes many hundreds of years back in history and is for our future generations. These are survival principles on this earth when we are being threatened, when we are being attacked by global principles of commercial and capitalistic driven purposes. So GMOs are a affront to tikanga Māori. Those are our Māori protocols. They are a breach of the Treaty of Waitangi. They are a threat to the health of Māori and all our environment, our conventional and organic agricultural. And we all know that biggest threat, or we are gathering those knowledges, is the contamination from genetically engineered crops and animals. We call this GMO pollution. So we optimistically from this hui are looking to make a collective stance, a mandate, as a whole island, as we did with GE-free, as we did with nuclear-free, that we can ban GMO from use in our environment and agriculture for Waiheke Island, and hopefully permeate Aotearoa. Kia ora mai koutou. I want to hand it over now to Eugene, who has been a prolific gardener, who has awesome gardens presently. For those that travel our island, Eden Terrace is one that is presently in stages. So I'll hand it to you, Jean. And kia ora, thank you for your time. Come to the hui. No mai, haere mai. Everybody welcome. Come and join us and share in endorsing our fire, standing for our Greens principles, and to share full information and optimistically under the banner of piritahi, which means together as one, address and come together as one to stand as Waiheke Collective. Kia ora mai tata.
Kia ora whai. Can I just ask you, so the hui starts at 11 and people should bring something?
Bring a plate.
That's always great. And we'll share a meal afterwards. And I'm aware that a lot of people who are concerned about this issue might be at the market already because they're working and that's their source of income. However, if you wanted to post comments on the radio site, it might be possible to read some comments or address some of those comments at the hui.
Absolutely.
Really, it's a preliminary hui that's been organised at very short notice, and it's been tagged on to the welcome for Fire Denise, and so it's just to get a sort of a sense of where people are at on the island on this issue and how interested they are and raise some awareness. There might be some speakers who know a little bit about it. Denise herself said she knows a little bit about the food bill. Great. So, Matua, you are a kumara grower extraordinaire, and you've grown every year. You increase your yield of kumaras. How many kilos did you manage to grow last year?
We managed to grow. I think it was between myself and the Waiheke gardeners.
Sorry, I don't think that mic's working. So do you think you could come and sit over here? So we were just finding out between Eugene and the Waiheke gardeners that he's working with, how many kilos of kumara he's managed to grow.
Sorry about that, guys. Last year we managed to grow at least 2,000 kilos of kumara, which went out to various peoples on the island, mainly our old people. We'd like to make sure that they've had part of our crops.
So in a sense, you use this whole thing of bartering coming under the food bill and being regulated, that would really attack at the very heart of how you operate, because I think you end up bartering quite a lot of your produce or gifting it.
Mostly gifting it for various occasions. You know, as I say, we start off with all our kaumātua and kui, and then to the needy families alongside myself and the grow group. We help to supply the budget advice where we can, and all the other community groups, and also and we help with tangihanga if the veggies are available, and also 21sts, weddings, and community sort of fundraisers. And we've been doing it. It's sort of, to me, it's kind of an affront to sell your food, especially if we can grow it for nothing and you've got your community behind you. It's all about manaakitanga, and manaakitanga is basically helping those ones less fortunate.
And it works really well on Waiheke. I mean, we've got Piritahi Marae, which is an inclusive marae, but then also, I mean, these initiatives are partly Māori and partly Pākehā, and everybody working together to grow the food.
Well, it's not so much Pākehā Māori, it's community.
Mm.
It's community. This, the separation of Māori Pākehā, it's community.
Mm. I agree, and that's shown to work really well on Waiheke.
Because we, 20 years ago, we didn't have the population that we've got and the multinationals that are here. And, you look at most of our store owners now, they're all Hindi or Chinese, where when I first come to the island, it's all run by European. Things have changed, and they're going to change even more, especially with this food bill coming in. It's quite worrying, because from what I know about the bill, Monsanto's, I heard you with the previous talking about Monsanto's and what happened over in America where they grew their crops. They had a crop pollen drift to the neighbour, and that particular crop, from what I understand, had a frog gene in the seed. Now, ironically, it hopped over the paddock, and then Monsanto's took them to court, and luckily the opposing people, they had an ace up their sleeve. They turned around and says, well, how can you take us to court when it was your crop that jumped over to our paddock and therefore was trespass? So it means Monsanto's lost that. Then they went back to the drawing board, and then they added a dead gene to their stock, their scientists. So in fact what happens is when their crops now, when they pollinate, the pollination gets on the wind and drifts. But the fear here is, and it's a very real fear, that with this dead gene pollination, it'll drift onto all our native flora and fauna. And they say, the scientists say, within 50 years, all our natural seeds will be contaminated, and they'll become weaker and weaker till all our, not only our native flora and fauna, but all the vegetable seeds that we grow here in Aotearoa. You know, up in my garden, I've got our taro that came out with the wokas, the white taro, and then our white corn, our kamukamu, our kumara that was brought out with the sealers and whalers, because the kumara we have today is not the kumara of yesteryear, of our tūpuna time. Our tūpuna had the long purple kumara, which was quite hard to grow and quite hard to store. And but with the advent of the sealers and whalers, when their crops failed, I'm talking about the whales and the seals were sort of just about decimated in around Aotearoa, they decided to grab the spurs, the kauri spurs, to export. And in turn, they were bringing their vegetables from different parts of the world and brought them here for trade with our tūpuna, which in turn not only took hold of the poo, the gun, but also they took hold of the seed, they took hold of all the iron implements and that. And by the time Governor Gray came here, our tūpuna had flour mills up and down the country, different iwi, and they were doing quite well, trading with and supplying food and to the colonists, but also they were exporting food to Sydney. And then from Sydney, our kai was going further afield. As an example, a big, huge, old-fashioned golden queen peach, which would have been just about the size of an apple, was fetching a shilling in the Californian gold mines.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep. And at this time, our second Māori king, he had a pound note. Our tūpuna were ready to open their own bank and start trading that way. And that's when the powers to be brought in Governor Gray, and he systematically started from the top of the North Island right down to the bottom, not only attacking the parasites, but they were attacking the gardens. Smashed all the flour mills, and then they hold all the river-going walkers and what have you to eliminate all the transporting. So, as you know, if you don't put your seed in the garden in the right time, then you don't have any crops. So that was the idea too.
Right, so it was not only attacking the parasite, but also attacking the source of food.
Not so much the source of food, but the source of income.
Mm.
You know, the food was only a vehicle to get what you can out of it. And then now we have
Monsanto.
Well, basically Monsanto, but also what really scares me is this free trade agreement with America. It shouldn't happen, personally.
So you're talking about the TPPA now?
The whole thing. Opening up Aotearoa to this type of thing is going to be horrendous for everybody. The rich are going to get more richer and the poor are going to get more poor. And I'm seeing that around me today, here on Waiheke. Everybody thinks, come to Waiheke, it's a beautiful place, but to try and live here, as you know, it's quite hard.
Mm. I was trying to explain to an Aucklander who's a lawyer yesterday that people are not that wealthy on Waiheke, and he just laughed at me. He said, "Oh no, you know, they just don't. They just don't see.
No matter where you go, that people's when you tell people you live on Waiheke, they go, "Wow, you must be rich."
Mm. Now, the other interesting thing about this food bill, I've only looked at it very slightly, but one of the things that comes up, and I'd quite like your comment, either of you, is that it says that food for a charitable purpose, food that's prepared for a charitable purpose, should not occur more than 20 times in 1 year. What kind of ruling is that? And if it was, then you could be exempt from all this food handling type of thing. But if not, the other thing is that it's that I thought was quite interesting is that it said that it's too difficult to define a cottage industry. Therefore, every small business would have to be defined as a business and pay the costs of compliance, and that exemption could be worked out on a case-by-case basis. And I thought that was quite interesting because I thought, well, you know, it's not that difficult to work out the criteria for a home school. So presumably you ought to be able to work out what the criteria is for a cottage industry, that an employer is less than so many people or it makes less than so much money. So for me it really seemed to be about the pressure on smaller growers to not be able to afford almost to grow food and sell it because they couldn't make any money out of it at all or live off.
Well, to answer your question, I'll answer it in a roundabout way. The gardens you see on Eden Terrace, it's not only my work. You know, I can only do the physical work, but also with the help of our community growers like Jenny and the Forest and Bird, and they're busy on their crops, but also with the help of the organics lady down in Tahi Road there. She supplied seed. Danny Shortland, he's supplied seed that his family have been from up north have been growing for eons, and he's, you know, through the community we help, we can achieve these, because tell you what, it's really expensive and it comes out of my our back pockets to get these things happening, and to I really didn't think that we were going to get this far this year, but because of persistence and other people's help, we have. Because things are tough. There isn't that much money around. Myself, as a landscaper, I've downsized in my workload because there's not much work around.
So hence also the importance of growing food in a time when food is so expensive to buy.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly.
Now, listen, thank you so much for coming in.
Sure, mate.
Whai Huhana, Matua Ujin, and your son, lovely, great. And so see you at the Hui at 11 o'clock next Saturday to welcome Denise Roche as Green MP and also to talk about the food bill. If you're not able to make it but you still have a comment, perhaps you could post it on the radio site, or always write a letter to the Gulf News. That's that's what everyone does.
Kia ora, mate.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kia ora.
You've been listening to the Interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7pm and Thursdays at 12:30pm. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.